at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Call them Generation RX or the Medication Generation, a sizable group of American young adults whose formative years were shaped by psychiatric drugs. Our guest today is one of them, author Kristen Bell Barnett. And in her new book called Dosed, The Medication Generation Grows Up, she describes her own experiences along with those of other young people. Bell Barnett pinpoints the 1990s as the turning point in public attitudes. It was the decade of the brain, which saw breakthrough research on how brain chemistry affects mental health. And by the late 90s, medicines like Prozac, Zoloft, Ritalin were being marketed directly to consumers with the promise of cure for a whole host of woes. Parents also played a role, eager to fix their kids' problems, and many schools and doctors also jumped on board. But Bell Barnett writes this enthusiasm was based on very little research about the impact of these drugs on developing minds and bodies. Research, she says, is still lacking today. What's also missing is the stories of these young people themselves, how spending much of childhood on psychiatric drugs affects their sense of self and their mental health entering adulthood. Bell Barnett aims to fill that gap in her book, and today in The Exchange, we'll explore what she found, and let's hear from you. Did you spend part of your childhood on some kind of psychotropic drug? How has that experience affected you today? Also, if you're a parent involved in this issue right now, how do you weigh the costs and benefits of medicating kids, sometimes at young ages, over a long period of time? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And Caitlin Bell Barnett joins us from Western Massachusetts. And Caitlin, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this sudden rise in kids and teens taking psychiatric medicines has been described as a giant, uncontrolled experiment using America's children. Wow, Caitlin, what is that experiment, and is it as ominous as it sounds?
Well, I think it does sound a little bit more scary in those terms than perhaps it is. But what it is was a bunch of doctors and researchers essentially not having the studies at their fingertips, and them recognizing increasingly in the 1980s and 90s that children could indeed really suffer from many of the same conditions that adults could suffer from, the same kind of psychiatric conditions, and also some different conditions that you would see more often in children, conduct disorders, ADHD, the autism, quote-unquote, epidemic we began to see starting to take off in the 1990s. And there was a real concern that these conditions needed to be treated. And therapy, various therapies were one way of treating them, but a whole host of drugs began to come on the market at the same time in the 1990s. And so doctors, understandably, with new tools at their disposal, wanted to use those tools. Unfortunately, they didn't have the studies to sort of back them up, and so they got a little ahead of themselves and started using the tools without the evidence behind it.
Wow. So wanting to help people, genuinely, new tools at their disposal, as you said, why would doctors and parents and teachers and others jump on this bandwagon without the research to back it up?
Well, I think there was a genuine desire to help troubled children, and there was an increasing diagnosis of children in the 1980s and 1990s, and that was for a variety of reasons. You know, you could say increasing awareness. You could say loosening psychiatric criteria. You could say that in past generations, we would have just called these kids bad kids or juvenile delinquents, or perhaps the really troubled ones, we would have just put them away in institutions and forgotten about them.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about that if we could. You know, again, you described the 90s as the decade of the brain and how that changed the way we think about kids and teens and their problems. So just a little more, if you could, Caitlin, how did we approach this before the wide availability of drugs? If a child or teen was having emotional struggles or mental health issues, how did we look at this or approach it?
Well, I think a lot had to do on depended how dysfunctional and how troubled the child or the teenager was. I think the more mildly troubled kids, probably it was dismissed in a lot of cases as a phase. I think certain kinds of families who were maybe more keyed into psychoanalysis, perhaps more privileged families where the parents were already doing psychoanalysis, that kind of upper crust, small percentage, perhaps the kids would have been placed in intensive talk therapy, but that was a minority. I think that many of the kids, you know, we would have just said they're just going through a phase, that they'll pass out of it. Like I said, the really developmentally troubled ones would have been put away in institutions in past generations. Others would have been dismissed as bad kids, you know, and the really bad ones would have been, you know, sort of fallen into a life of crime, right? So I think that they would have taken a variety of paths, and what ended up happening instead, and what's increasingly happening, is that all of those kids who would have taken these different paths are increasingly sort of being diagnosed with conditions and medicated.
And to some extent, then, it's a good thing. I mean, it sounds like some kids before would have just been dropped by the wayside.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that is true. You know, and inevitably, you are going to sweep up some kids who many people are going to say should not be on medication, who are just going through a phase, and it's a trade-off.
You know, and what we're getting into is what you call in the book sort of that tired, predictable debate that we've been having for 20 years. You know, is this a good idea or isn't it? Is it behavioral? Is it parenting? Is it schools? Is it whatever? You say, look, I want to, in this book, get beyond that pro-med, anti-med debate. What are you hoping to add to this, Caitlin, with this book and move beyond that, again, tired, predictable discussion?
Exactly. Well, what I'm hoping to add is to actually hear from the young people themselves and to hear about the texture of their actual experiences. So rather than debating this in the abstract, like should we be diagnosing kids with these conditions? Is it a good thing to be loosening the diagnostic criteria? Should we be prescribing the medication? I want to get at this idea, okay, well, what about the kids who have been prescribed medication already? Let's see how that turned out. And so what I did is I interviewed several dozen people who were more or less my age, so ranging in age now from about 20 years old to their mid-30s, and I had them reflect back, and then I retrospectively told their stories of their time on medication.
And really compelling stories. And some kids starting as young as, I think one of your subjects started as young as 5, Caitlin. I mean, wow, what did that person have to say about starting so young?
Yeah. He was one of the main subjects. A couple other people did start actually that young, who were sort of ancillary people that I interviewed. But this particular young man that I think you're thinking of, I call him Paul in the book to protect his identity. He was in the Florida foster care system. He had one of the more negative experiences with medication, and I think that was really really colored by a whole host of other kind of external circumstances having to do with his situation in this institutional setting in the foster care system, where he ended up in the foster care system because he was an abused and traumatized child. So this was already a very troubled boy who was, from what I can tell, really acting out sort of bouncing off the walls, a very charming and lovely little boy at times, but also extremely difficult to get under control from the adult's point of view. They put him on Ritalin. The mistake, from what I can tell, is that people didn't explain to him in a compassionate way why they were giving him medication, and what he just gleaned that they were giving it to him because he was a bad kid, and that it was to fix him, and that nobody loved him, and that the medication was basically a substitute for a loving family, and that sort of made sense because what ended up happening is he just bounced from placement to placement to placement, in part because he was so badly behaved. And so it was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so these two things very much got wrapped up for him, his bad associations with the medication and his bad associations with the foster care system are kind of impossible to separate.
Wow. Well, I want to invite our listeners to join us too. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, Dose, the Medication Generation Grows Up. Our guest is the author, Caitlin Bell Barnett. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Caitlin, I have to say, you know, you fit into this narrative too of the decade of the brain. When you were 17, you'd been depressed for some time. You started taking Prozac. That process of coming to that decision, was it a quick ABC, yes, let's do this, or was there lots of conversation leading up to it?
No, there's quite a lot of conversation, and it was something that I had been thinking about for many years myself. I had, as you say, I had already been depressed for sort of by my own account, I guess, 4 or 5 years. And I had sort of been, I had been in therapy for a number of years, and I had been hoping, I had read about antidepressants and had been hoping that somebody would offer me antidepressants, and nobody did. My parents had qualms about putting me on long-term medication. They were very concerned about the lack of studies, I think rightly so. And my pediatrician, I think, wasn't fully clued in to quite how depressed I was because, like I said, I was seeing therapists, so I was sort of in this kind of split care. And I actually asked, finally, to be put on medication. And so that was a very different situation, for example, from what I just described.
And I will get back to that after a short break. We'll start taking your calls, too. So join us, and we'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from S&W Sports, hosting the 4th Annual Concord Bike Swap May 12th and Sunday, May 13th to support Central New Hampshire Bicycle Coalition. Details at swsports.net. And Kimball Union Academy, a coeducational boarding and day school for grades 9 through 12 and postgraduate in Meriden, New Hampshire. KUA.org, creating a vision for the world. More on the medication generation growing up on the exchange on NHPR at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather today, clouding up, slight chance of showers, maybe an isolated thunderstorm, highs from upper 50s north country, ranging to upper 60s in southern parts of the state. Tonight, partly cloudy in the evening, then clearing, lows from upper 20s northern parts of the state, ranging to around 40 in southern New Hampshire. Tomorrow, sunny, highs from upper 60s north, ranging to upper 70s in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the author of a new book called Dosed, The Medication Generation Grows Up. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Did you take psychiatric medication as a child or teen? What effect did it have on you then? And how do you think about it now as you move into young adulthood? Also, if you're a parent involved in these questions surrounding the use of psychiatric drugs for your child, tell us about your experience, how you're weighing this issue. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Caitlin, just before the break, you were talking about your own experiences, how, you know, you were depressed for some time before you actually went on Prozac. How do you think you might have fared if you'd grown up in that earlier era that we talked about, you know, the 60s and 70s, and hadn't been prescribed the Prozac?
Well, I think I just would have probably continued to suffer in the same way that I did, which is that, you know, I was not suffering from a deep, deep depression. I was, I had something called dysthymia, which is sort of a low-level, very long-lasting depression. And I think that probably just would have continued. You know, maybe it would have abated for a while when I went off to college and started to cheer up a little bit, but I suspect it would have returned. You know, the data says that usually people who experience that kind of sustained depression for such a long time, generally it's not just a one-time thing, that it will come back. So I'm grateful to medication. I don't think it's been a totally simple experience for me. The medication did stop working after about 5 years, and that created its own problems. But at the time, that was a really, really helpful thing for me as a teenager to have access to it.
Wow. What did you do once it stopped working after about 5 years?
That was really, really difficult, and that's something that I write about in the book also in a larger sense, not just in my case. I began to experience intense anxiety symptoms and had, I mean, for lack of a better term, basically a sort of nervous breakdown. I think that can be really devastating for young people who have a history of medication use, where they sort of think that they have everything figured out. Mm. And the fact is that young people are growing and changing, and medications for people of any age can stop working. But there can be a sense of you sort of can delude yourself into thinking that, okay, well, I got early treatment. You know, I got early intervention, and I went off to college, and I became successful, and
I'm all good now.
I'm all good. Set. You know, I'm on my way. Right. That was something that I saw not just in my own experience, but also from interviewing other people, that could be quite difficult for them when they experienced a relapse or a breakdown after having had successful treatment in the past.
And those relapses or breakdown, Caitlin, you write very compellingly, are linked to this fundamental question that medication generation has, and that is, it's kind of existential, but, you know, who am I really? And a question that we all struggle with, especially as we enter young adulthood, but throughout life. But you say for this generation, that's a really poignant and sometimes sharp question. Who am I really?
Yes. And I think in the context of the breakdowns, you know, does it mean, am I somebody who is fundamentally flawed, who is going to go through life with a disorder, who needs medication in the long term? Or am I somebody who just had a little blip as a young person and perhaps can get off the medication at some point? And how has the medication affected me? Was it something that I could just take and then go on my merry way? Or am I, as I say, is there some essential flaw, you know, whether you want to call it genetic or biological or just, you know, a character flaw or personality flaw that means that I need medication in the long term.
Yeah, you're right. My cohort lives with some powerful contradictions. So this is what you're hearing from people.
Yeah.
Let's take some calls and emails from our listeners, Caitlin. Hear from them. Our number again, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. The book we're talking about is called Dosed, The Medication Generation Grows Up. It's by Caitlin Bell Barnett, and it looks again at the experiences of those Americans now entering young adulthood who spent a fair bit of their childhoods taking psychiatric medications, whether Prozac, Zoloft, Ritalin, and a number of others. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Caitlin, first up is Courtney in Concord. Hi, Courtney. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
Hi. I was put on medication when I was 15 years old, and I didn't know at the time what the long-term effects would be, and I was just interested in getting a little help. I was really depressed, and my mom thought it was a good idea. And I'm 24 now, and I've just barely gotten off Effexor, and I've been put onto Prozac, and only in the past couple of weeks, a mood stabilizer, which is really helped out a lot for anxiety and between surroundings and traumatic issues and long-term psychiatric problems within the family. That's, you know, where I am. And I just wanted to say that I don't know if it's how bad the long-term effects are and if it's worth it even with the long-term effects, you know, so that you can feel good for so many years on the medication, even if there are long-term damaging effects. And I'd love to read the book, and I can take the comment off the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Courtney, thank you so much for calling in. What do you think, Caitlin? Did you hear other people say what Courtney said? You know, these have been wonderful for me, and a little concerned about the long-term effects, but this has really helped.
Yes, that was a really common response, and I sympathize with that that kind of conflict that she has, that kind of fundamental conflict. The fact is that your teenage years and your youth are kind of precious, and you only have so many of those years to go through, and you don't want to waste them with being anxious or depressed or just unhappy or unstable in any way. And, you know, it's one thing to spend a few months like that, but it's another thing to spend years and years. So I think that that many people feel that if they can get some of those years back and really have them be productive, it's a short-term trade-off that they're really willing to make. And yes, they don't know the long-term effects, but in the short term, it's a sure thing that they'll take.
What do you think about the idea, Caitlin, that given that these drugs are here, and don't take this the wrong way, but given that these drugs are here, we as a society don't have to work through the tough stuff. We can just pop a pill.
Well, you know,
I know you've heard this before,
yeah.
So.
I have heard it before. I think that in many ways, the drugs do not resolve all of people's issues and all of people's problems. I think that they make people sometimes more able to face the tough stuff. So that if you, just to take the example of depression, if you are really, truly depressed, you really can't even begin to face the tough stuff because you're so depressed. Whereas if you begin to take an antidepressant, it doesn't solve your problems for you. It doesn't allow you to repair your relationships. The pill doesn't repair your relationships for you. It doesn't allow you to get a job or fix fundamental problems in your life. What it does do is allow you to sort of see a way out.
And get out of bed and start working on it.
Exactly. And maybe start therapy. Get the energy to get a therapist and start, you know, or start talking to your friends about it or whatever it is. So that's the way that I think about it for myself, and that's the way I have heard other young people describe it to me.
All right. Well, Courtney, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. And you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. And Daniel's calling in from Boston. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hey, I'm just interested in knowing about relationship-wise. I was with a person that was on drugs for a long time. He is, still is. And it's been weird because he puts the drugs as an excuse for a lot of stuff. And it was very, very uncomfortable for me to try to tackle that. But it's something that I've seen with people that have been drugged, that they use it as a kind of crutch on life.
Can you give us an example, Daniel, from your relationship with this person?
Oh, well, even just taking care of me romantically, I would be like, no, I can't because of the drugs.
Mm.
You know, it hasn't, it romantically wise and, you know, bodily wise and physically, he wasn't able to.
Mm.
And that's a long-term effect that happens from being drugs. And when you're 25, 26, 27, that happens already in age. You know, it gets you to that point where you're going to need even more because you're depressed about it.
Wow. Daniel,
I feel it's a cycle that it's being created somehow. that I don't understand. And I just met someone recently again. I'm no longer with that other person, but I met someone recently that does the same thing. And he talks about the drugs, like if it's something that it's just part of my life. Like I have to take them because it's not, you know, this happens. And it's a long list of stuff, which is very weird to me.
Well, Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us. And we haven't talked about this yet. Caitlin, what did you hear from the people that you worked with on this book about the impact of psychiatric medications on relationships?
It could be really... It was a point of tension for many people, and it was often something that they were either not really comfortable discussing with their friends, or you know, close friends or romantic partners, or that they felt that their close friends or romantic partners didn't really understand. And I think it can be really, really difficult to try to explain, even to somebody that you're really close to, your quote-unquote relationship with the medication. That's something that I talk about in the book. You know, I think that in a way you develop a relationship with the drugs in a sense. They become a part of your life, especially if you've been taking them, you know, the longer you've been taking them and from the younger an age you've been taking them. And they almost can kind of come between you and somebody that you're close to. And I think it can really take a lot of work and a lot of discussion to try to explain how you feel about them and the role that they've played in your life and why they're so important to you. And I can say that even with my husband, you know, who I've been together with him for more than 7 years now, that's still something that I struggle to try to explain what my medications exactly mean to me.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
After all these years?
Yeah.
Well, Daniel, it's a great point. Thank you for bringing it up. And let's go next to Keene. Bev's on the phone. Hi, Bev. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I have a youngster who's now 20 who's been on antidepressants since he was 10. He was diagnosed with a low-incidence learning disability when he was 6. And without the medication, I know that my son would not be functioning. He is now in a very prestigious college, top of his class in high school. He ended up in a private high school for kids with learning disorders. And the medication made all the difference in the world. Kids with neurological issues can't pull it all together on their own and often end up in prison and in other places one would not like to see them. And medication can make a big deal.
How hard a decision was this for you, Bev, at that early age to put your son on these drugs?
When he was 10?
Yeah.
Not hard at all.
Yeah.
We saw what he was going through. We saw how anxious and depressed he was. We saw how he was not functioning, how his peer relationships were terrible.
Wow.
And once he went on the meds, it's night and day.
Wow. And how's it been with him now as a young adult? Does he have to sort of play with different medications or dosage? Or, you know, because Caitlin mentioned earlier that after 5 years, Prozac all of a sudden stopped working. Has he been okay with that?
Prozac's been known for Prozac poop out.
Oh.
So it doesn't surprise me that
yeah.
happened to her. He was initially on Celexa.
Mm-hmm.
When he reached 14 or 15, he started to sweat profusely. And we have a wonderful PA who we work with here. And he said, I think it's the meds. We're going to switch him from Celexa to... something similar. I don't
okay.
even remember what
and
it is.
And Bev, hang on one sec, because I did want to ask Caitlin about this. You know, you say that, and it's great to hear her story, by the way, Caitlin, and I'm sure you've heard other stories like
mm-hmm.
it, right?
Yes.
And the point that she made about the Prozac poop out, I hadn't heard that before.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that, Caitlin, how over long periods of time, sometimes it gets tricky trying to get the exact dose or get the right medicine and so forth?
Sure. You know, this is not an exact science. Psychiatry has an element of art to it, and doctors have to play around with dosages, and they have to play around with different medications. There's no, they can't the Holy Grail would be a test that would tell you exactly what medication would work perfectly for
right.
you. Psychiatrists would love to have a test like that, and they just don't. So there's a huge amount of trial and error, and sometimes they try something and it works for a while, and it just stops working. They don't fully understand exactly why that is. But for young people who start on medications early, it can be quite demoralizing, you know, to sort of be on basically a medication merry-go-round. Sometimes they go through many drugs before finding something that works. I mean, this caller is very lucky that for a while, you know, her son did have a great reaction, it sounds like, to Celexa. It sounds like she was also very lucky in the sense that their doctor really took those side effects very seriously, the sweating. That's something else that I think is so important for it might seem like a minor thing, but to a teenager, something like profuse sweating, I mean, that can be a really serious concern and can have serious social effects. So honestly, playing around with dosages and trying new drugs is just sort of part of the game when you're talking about long-term medication use.
That must be hard when young adults enter the work world, and let's say they're on a new job and they really want to prove themselves, and then it comes to a time period where you do have to, as you said, play around with new medications or dosage levels. You know, how do they approach that? You're again, you're wanting to make an impression in the workplace, but you're kind of going through a bumpy time with a new medication.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I hear from other people and that I've certainly experienced myself is a sense sometimes when a medication is working kind of okay for you and you know that it's really not working all that great anymore and you probably should switch things up, but you get a little bit lazy, especially with these drugs that can take some time to work, like antidepressants, where you don't really want to put in the time to go through multiple medication trials, and you just get sort of lazy and you're like, okay, this is really not working for me and I'm sort of anxious or I'm sort of depressed or whatever it is, but I just this isn't a good time for me to be really playing around with my medications, so I'm just going to stick with this one that works kind of okay because there's never really a good time for a real breakdown. I've had people say that to me. I don't want to go off this one that's working sort of okay because what if I go on another one and it really doesn't work?
Right, and I've got a big project coming up at work or a business trip or
exactly.
something. Well, thanks for that call, and we will take a lot more of your calls after a short break. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
For the past 9 months, we've been exploring New Hampshire's immigration story. Well, we're wrapping up our coverage with a series of special shows on The Exchange, including a Socrates Exchange, pondering who is an American. There'll be reports from the newsroom, and we'll cap it all off with an hour-long documentary chronicling the last 200 years of New Hampshire's immigration story. Tune in and visit nhpr.org for more information. Made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and the Joslin Diabetes Center affiliate at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, offering comprehensive diabetes care to patients across southeastern New Hampshire. FrisbeeHospital.com. And the McLean Law Firm and its employment law group, representing businesses and employment law matters from risk management to litigation, online at mclane.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, the future of nursing in the Granite State. Email us your thoughts and concerns before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us Monday morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, the medication generation grows up. We're talking with author Caitlin Bell Barnett about her book on young adults who spent much of their formative years taking psychiatric drugs, how it's affecting them now as they move into adulthood. Join us with your comments, questions, and personal experiences. Did you take psychiatric medication as a child or teen? What effect did it have on you then? How do you think it's affected you now as you move into adulthood? Also, if you're a parent involved in this issue of psychiatric drugs for your child, tell us about your own experiences, how you're weighing the costs and benefits of this. 1-800-892-6477 is our number, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And Caitlin, let's go right back to our listeners. And Camilla's calling from Hampton. Hi, Camilla. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I was listening to your show today, and I, first of all, my heart certainly goes out to these parents. And, you know, we have to recognize that there are times, obviously, when medication can be necessary in a crisis situation. But I do believe that it should be more on a short-term basis, while we're looking for the underlying cause. And being in the healthcare field, I certainly recognize and see these problems very clearly. And what's so frightening is that the incidence of diagnosis has just skyrocketed. And the, more and more children are put on these psychotropic drugs without us really knowing the long-term side effects.
And you say you're in the healthcare field, Camilla. What do you do in the healthcare field?
I'm a chiropractor.
Okay, yeah.
And we have a busy family practice in Beverly, Massachusetts. And we see a lot of kids. We talk to a lot of parents, and we're certainly aware of these problems. However, when you work with wellness and understand that these are chemical issues, underlying chemical problems. We look at our lifestyle, our children's diet, which is often toxic and deficient. You know, what the building blocks for these chemicals that are necessary for homeostasis in the body, for wellness in the body, need to be present in order for the body to be able to produce these chemicals.
Well, and Camilla, I hear what you're saying, and it's definitely something that I wanted to raise with you, Caitlin. Skeptical that too many kids are being diagnosed, and I've heard others say this too, concerned that this isn't really about chemical imbalances, but more about lifestyle issues. Bad diets, kids not getting outside, spending all their days staring at a screen, less connected to the real world. And that's partly why we see a rise in these mental health issues. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's something to be said for that, and that there are some lifestyle interventions that I don't want to say everybody, I'm not a mental health professional and I'm not a doctor, but that I think many people would be well advised to try before, putting their kids on medication. I think certainly the argument that we're getting rid of recess, that kids are getting less exercise, there's great evidence that exercise improves mood, all of those things. Encouraging your kids to get out in nature, those kinds of lifestyle interventions, I think would be well advised and a good sort of first step. And even if your child is on medication or for young people who are on medication, including myself, I try to get exercise to boost my mood. I think that they're great sort of augmentation strategies or just a good sort of first step. From everything I've seen, many parents, before putting their children on medication, have tried a lot of alternative means, and that parents are often not the ones pushing the medication in the first place, so that they have often tried many other strategies like diet modification, like trying to get their kids more exercise, et cetera, without luck. And that medication is, I don't want to say an absolute last-ditch strategy, but that they are sort of, in many ways, at the end of their rope here. So I think it's maybe a little bit misleading, some of these critics who say that medication is a quick fix here, or that we're jumping to medication, because many of the interviews that I've seen with parents who do put their kids on meds, and young people who choose to go on medication, it's not as though they're willy-nilly going to that as a first step without thinking about other kinds of therapies or treatments.
So the impression of, oh, we're just a pill-popping society, you're saying not really the case.
I think people are very willing to try other strategies if the other strategies will work. And sometimes they do work, and then sometimes they don't, and people need to go to medication.
Yeah. Does anybody do talk therapy anymore, or is that basically, you know, not part of the picture for this generation?
Well, unfortunately, many insurance plans will not cover talk therapy at all, or will really only cover a very limited number of sessions. So I think a lot of people that I talked to said that they would really be amenable to talk therapy, but that it just really wasn't an option for them financially.
Wow. So that's another interesting point, isn't it, Caitlin, that partly people who are struggling in their young years would love to sit down with a therapist, but it's not covered, so they just get the pill because that is covered.
Yeah, I mean, they were also saying this in retrospect, being young adults. I have a section in my book about how teenagers can sometimes be very resistant to talk therapy because, you know, they don't want adults prying into their private lives. So I think sometimes getting especially teenagers to open up can be very tough.
Yeah, and there's some almost, you know, it'd be funny if it weren't so sad. There's a story about one of the young gals, sort of a preteen, who goes to talk therapy and, you know, doesn't tell the therapist anything bad. You know, it's all sunshine and roses. And when her mother says, did you talk to the therapist about, you know, the dishes you threw across the room last week, or, you know, the huge fight you got into or whatever, she says, no, I don't want him to know about that. You know? All right. Well, again, thanks for that call, Camilla. Good points. And our number, 1-800-892-6477. Forrest is waiting in Portsmouth. Hi, Forrest. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. There's a couple things I wanted to say. For one, I grew up a little bit before this whole medicate your child thing, and I wound up in a psychiatric hospital followed by a reform school, and as an adult discovered that I have ADD and OCD and a few other things.
Wow, Forrest, you know, so this could have helped you, you're saying?
Well, it could have. Who knows? You know what I'm saying? But I just wanted to point out that, yes, that did happen. That's a real thing that some kids, you know, sort of fell through the cracks in that sort of a system prior to these medications being available. And on the other hand, I am now the mother of a 9-year-old daughter who we've just started to medicate for anxiety issues. And I think the thing I want to say the most, you know, first of all, we've been seeing a therapist for almost 4 years now, and her anxiety is having negative physical effects on her. And I think Caitlin pointed out one thing, but it was just briefly. The thing that I think is the most important, once you've come to the decision that medication is something you really need to try, I think it's extremely important to make sure that the child understands that this is not a negative thing, and just be really, really honest with them about why they're taking it. That way they don't have that sort of, you know, that negative stigma, you know, about, oh, this is just to fix me because there's something wrong with me. You know, for my daughter, it's no different than taking her asthma medication, you know. And I think that's a big, that's one of the most important things, like I said, aside, once you've made the decision, you really need to have, no matter what age your child is, you need your child to be involved in that decision.
Wow. And
Forrest, to understand.
What a story you had about your own life. And Caitlin, you have written and blogged about exactly what she's talking about. You know, don't try to sugarcoat this for the kids, and don't try to overly hide them from what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. I think explaining the reasons for the medication, in a developmentally appropriate way is so important. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't speak to exactly the way that might be appropriate for kids of different ages, but I think that it's so important to consult with the mental health professionals that you're seeing and try to get their take on what might be an appropriate way to do that. And also, you know, parents know their kids better than anybody, right? So they can gauge what might be, you know, appropriate and also might just work with the child's personality and might engage them and click with them. So I think that that's so important for not to feel something, not to feel forced upon them so that they rebel against it. And also just for them to understand, really. One psychiatrist that I interviewed said that, you know, he uses the analogy of glasses. Like, well, would you go without your glasses? No. It's, you know, it's just, it's a tool that helps you function the same way that many other kids function normally. It's just something that you happen to need.
Got an email from Kristen this morning, just picking up on what you said, Caitlin. She says, telling a severely depressed person to manage their illness without medication is like telling a type 1 diabetic whose body doesn't produce insulin to manage their disease with diet. So she's kind of following up on what you were just saying there. Mm-hmm. Let's take one more call if we could. This is David calling in from Carroll County. Hi, David. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to call from the just from the side of a person who should have been medicated and wasn't, and the suffering that ultimately caused. I'm sure some people are medicated who shouldn't be, but at 5 I had what can only be described as a psychotic break, and ultimately it was poo-pooed and passed off as just stress for a 5-year-old child, and I basically suffered with major depressive disorder. My all through my childhood,
wow.
Which ultimately led me to drugs and alcohol at 11 and 12 years old, which ultimately led me into almost spending the rest of my life in prison.
David, what a story. Wow. Go ahead.
And it really came down to, I think at that time, there was the inability to diagnose and treat a child at that time. And later on, it wasn't until my mid-20s I ultimately, after getting sober and getting off of the drugs and alcohol, that I found a doctor who had the courage to say, hey, this is what's wrong with you, and you need medicine, and you can't manage this by willpower. The email or the call that said, it's like trying to treat diabetes with willpower, it's not going to work. If someone needs to be medicated, they need to be medicated. You can save a child a lot of trouble if it's properly diagnosed early on.
Well, David, thanks for calling in. And boy, Caitlin, there you go. Somebody who isn't part of the medication generation and might have benefited from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's another reason that we saw the rise of the medication generation is that, you know, many of their parents and older brothers and sisters, so to speak, you know, suffered a great deal and felt that they might have been saved a lot of that suffering if their conditions had been diagnosed and treated earlier. And, you know, I think that those feelings were very genuine and well-meaning. And they were just trying to save these kids the kind of suffering that they experienced in many cases.
Well, Caitlin, so the book is done. What's been the reaction so far as you go around and start talking about these issues with people, especially people of your generation who've been through this?
Well, the reaction has really run the gamut. I mean, I think as we've seen on this show, people have a whole variety of experiences with medication, and people bring their own views and their own experiences to the book, which I think is great. I think that's really wonderful. You know, I'm not trying to come down really strongly. You know, like I say, I'm trying to get past this pro-medication, anti-medication debate, and so if people can just see that there is some more nuance to these experiences and just be made aware, like I say, of just the whole range of experiences that medication can create, I think I'm doing my job.
And you're trying to keep the book alive by having people continue their story so that they know they're not alone.
Yes, I am. I would absolutely love to continue to hear people's stories, and I am continuing to tell them. I have a blog at Psych Central, the website, called My Meds Myself, where I continue to blog about these issues, and I sometimes feature guest posts where I tell people's stories.
Wow, we've heard some amazing stories this hour. And a little bit after the show closes out, Caitlin, we'll put a link on our website, nhpr.org, if people want to do that. You know, given all of your research, Caitlin, what do you tell your friends who are having kids now about this option of maybe putting a child on psychiatric medications, but feeling really unsure? You know, I know you've blogged about this too. What do you say to people who are going, my child seems to be struggling, but I don't know if I want to take that step or not?
Well, I would really advise them, not to jump into it, first of all. I think it is a big decision. I think that, like we say, we don't know these medications' effects. So I would say gather as much research as you possibly can. There are studies out there. So when I say that there are not long-term studies, there are short-term studies about, for instance, the effects of Ritalin can temporarily stunt kids' growth, that kind of thing. So I say do as much research as you can. If you see continuing dysfunction in kids for months and months and months, you know, don't let them continue to suffer. Try multiple therapeutic strategies. So don't just go to medication. You know, if you can, try to see different kinds of therapists, experiment with alternative treatments, and get multiple opinions. Okay. From different doctors and different professionals, I would say.
Well, Caitlin, this has been real interesting. Thank you very much for your time today. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Caitlin Bell Barnett, Brooklyn-based journalist and blogger. The book we talked about, Dosed, The Medication Generation Grows Up. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. We have help this week from Todd Bookman. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.